Welcome to Film Forum's podcast. The following event was recorded on January 7th, 2015, live at our theaters located at 209 West Houston Street in Manhattan.
Good evening. It's my great pleasure to welcome the Oscar-winning director, our special guest, William Friedkin, who's come all the way from balmy Los Angeles to be here tonight. I can't believe he picked the coldest day of the year to be here. His last appearance at Film Forum was via Skype. In fact, he was our second Skype interview ever, following Norman Lloyd, 99-year-old Norman Lloyd, who gave him his first job, so that's right. Anyway, but he's not here tonight to discuss his own work, but as a devotee of Orson Welles, and particularly of his astonishing first film. So please welcome the director of The French Connection, The Exorcist, Sorcerer, and many other great classics of his own, William Friedkin.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Thank you so much. Can you guys hear me all right? I can't think of anything else that would bring me to New York in this weather. And this is the main reason I'm here. In fact, it's the only reason I'm here. But Bruce asked me to introduce a couple of other of Welles' films, which I happily agreed to do. Welcome to all of you, especially for braving this weather. But I guess I'm from Chicago, so this is like spring to me. But it's pretty warm in L.A. now, and I can do all my work via email right now. But I chose to come here to not only introduce this film, but to lead a discussion about it afterwards, because I wouldn't call it a Q&A, because I can't be the A for Orson Welles. No way. But how many of you have seen this film? Could you raise your hands? I'm leaving right now. As you know, this film needs no introduction. But this was the film that I saw when I was 20 years old that made me want to make films. Before that, I had only seen, you know, movies on Saturday afternoon or, you know, take a young unsuspecting woman as my date up to the uppermost balcony of the Uptown Theater in Chicago. But this is the first film that I had ever seen. It changed the course of my life. I was working at a television station in Chicago, directing live TV, which was, you know, what they were doing in live TV, many of you, nothing of great interest. A lot of news, cooking shows, pretty much what they have on now in the afternoon, and Chicago Cubs games, which had a loyal audience, even with no victories. And someone casually suggested that there was a film playing at the Surf Theater on Dearborn and Division Street in Chicago, and it was a very good movie, is all he said. He said, "You ought to see it. I think you'd like it." It was 1955. And it's 14 years after Kane was released. I knew nothing about it. I knew nothing about Orson Welles, nothing about the whole hassle connected with its production and then the subsequent really vicious drive to suppress it. I just sat down in a theater at the first showing of it, which was the noon show. And I stayed until midnight. I stayed through, five straight shows. And I found it flabbergasting. I couldn't believe it. I thought when I left the theater that that's what I wanted to do. Whatever that is, that's what I wanted to do. I didn't know what that was. I didn't know that it was really the intelligence of one man who gathered around him some of the finest people who could collaborate on a film, but that it was basically his vision, his intelligence that informed this entire experience. And over the years, I came to learn more and more about it, some of which a lot of you probably already know. Wells got this incredibly rich contract from RKO right after he did the Martian broadcast in 1938, where it was a dramatic radio show that suggested people from Mars had invaded New Jersey. And people were actually terrified and leaving the city and jumping out of windows. The stories are endless. They believed it. And when someone was asked to explain how so many people could be so stupid as to believe this was real, the common answer was most intelligent people that night were listening to Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy, which is weird because Edgar Bergen was a ventriloquist and Charlie McCarthy was a dummy and he's on the radio. I never understood that. But the Martian broadcast, adapted from an H.G. Wells novel, was a huge scandal, as well as being a success. And Wells had also directed a lot of great trailblazing works for the theater. And he got an incredibly rich contract from RKO. The first film he was going to make was Heart of Darkness. And he prepared the script. And it was, they wrote a script to do Heart of Darkness, the Joseph Conrad novel, that much later, as you all know, I'm sure, Francis Coppola adapted as Apocalypse Now. But Wells' first film at RKO in what was a two-picture deal was going to be Heart of Darkness. Heart of Darkness, the budget for that script came in at about $1,100,000, which is the catering budget of a Christopher Nolan film. But that was too much for RKO in those days. He actually requested 3,000 native extras. And the Screen Extras Guild reported to him that there was a Tarzan picture being made where they had a request for 500 native extras, and they couldn't fill that. So for various reasons like that, he didn't make Heart of Darkness. He then went on to try and make a kind of a thriller called Smiler with a Knife, which had been sort of a well-known but not best-selling novel. And finally, that didn't work, and he was under contract for a year before the idea occurred to him and to Herman J. Mankiewicz to make a film about a publishing tycoon and his love for, or his more than love, his ambition for a young and talentless woman who became his mistress. It's unclear whose idea this was. It really is. There are many books written about the making of Citizen Kane and all of Wells' films. Mankiewicz claims that he suggested the subject to Wells because Mankiewicz, who was a critic, he was the first film critic for The New Yorker. He was a correspondent, and he knew William Randolph Hearst. And it's pretty reasonable to suggest that because of his knowledge of Hearst, the fact that he had been up to San Simeon as a guest, that the idea originated with Mankiewicz at a dinner that he had with Wells before this process even started. Mankiewicz was banned from the Hearst castle because he used to throw up between courses of the dinner. And so he was finally excused. But Wells credits him with a lot of things. First of all, well, I'm not going to do any spoilers here, but Wells credits him with coming up with the concept of Rosebud, and he credits him with a beautiful speech that Everett Sloan, who plays Mr. Bernstein, gives somewhere about a third of the way into this film. And Mankiewicz worked on the first draft in a place called Victorville, California, which is about 85 miles outside of Los Angeles, a rather deserted desert resort. And Mankiewicz, who was a heavy drinker, was up there to keep away from the booze, and his keeper was John Houseman, who had worked extensively with Wells in theater and in radio. And Houseman and Mankiewicz, it's a draft exists that I've seen, a 300-page draft of Citizen Kane, which is obviously far more extensive than the finished film. That draft was sent to Wells, who did a lot of rewriting on it, back to Mankiewicz, who did more rewrites. They never seem to have gotten together, and their separate assistants claim that their boss wrote the script. Mankiewicz, the woman who typed Mankiewicz's script, said she never saw a script from Wells, and vice versa. But they did work together and produced, ultimately, seven drafts of the script which you're about to see. To me, the most important aspect of Wells's genius was his knack for picking the right collaborators. The man who did the makeup in this film, which is as good a makeup job as I've ever seen, he's the man who influenced Dick Smith, who did the makeup for Little Big Man, as well as The Exorcist. He was influenced by not only Seiderman's work, but his techniques. Maurice Seiderman was the name of the makeup artist. He doesn't get credit on the film. He was the same age as Wells, 25 years old, but he was non-union. He was not in the makeup artists' union. But he had done a lot of work as a non-union makeup artist. He did the makeup, Raymond Massey's makeup for Abe Lincoln in Illinois, among many other major jobs, and he had his own techniques. The greatest living cameraman in that day was Greg Toland, who turned up at Wells' office and said, "I want to work with you." And Wells said, "Why?" And he said, "Because the only way I can learn anything out here now is from someone who doesn't know anything about making film, but is curious and will have ideas that most of the present directors will think impossible. And that's what I want to do." Robert Wise was his film editor. Later had a distinguished career as a film director. The assistant editor was Mark Robeson, another very successful director later. All of the people connected with Kane, Perry Ferguson, the art director, was a young man as well, like Wells, eager to break new ground. For many years, I've heard a lot of the stories about things that happened on the set that I always thought were simply myths. I had heard that at one point, Wells wanted to put the camera so low on the floor for a scene that you will see, and Toland said to him, "Orson, I can't go any lower with the camera. I can't take any more parts off of it without digging a hole in the studio floor." And Wells said, "Well, let's go ahead and do it." Now, I always believed that that was either a myth or a lie, because a lot of both have sprung up around Wells in this picture. Until about a month ago, I was at the Directors Guild in L.A., and I saw a photograph on the wall of Wells in makeup and Greg Toland and the camera in a hole in the floor, which I think Bruce says he's got out there somewhere. So what I'm going to say to you now before I end this little conversation is if you got sheets of paper up there, out there, and anyone wants to sign up and write their email, and you email me, I will email you this photograph. Anyone in the theater who wants it. I consider it one of the most important still photos in the history of American film. These two masters standing in a hole in the floor to get the camera lower. It's some indication of the lengths to which they went to innovate. Deep focus photography, which was achieved a number of ways, which we can talk about later. But there is no doubt, even though William Randolph Hearst tried to get this film stopped, he actually had an FBI investigation of Wells when the film was delayed, and they had some agents who sent back reports to J. Edgar Hoover that Wells was a communist sympathizer. They tried everything possible to stop this film. I ask you to just imagine it. You have somehow or other got to create what is arguably the greatest American film, and they try to ban it, and they want to burn it. Louis B. Mayer offered the full cost of the negative to RKO to sell him the film so he could burn it. This film was delayed, its release was delayed for months, and attempts were made to destroy it. Fortunately, it has lived. Like so many great works of art, like Vincent van Gogh, who really didn't sell a painting in his lifetime. And if it wasn't for Van Gogh's sister-in-law, we would not have Van Gogh's paintings. She saved them all. She put them around with the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, friends' apartments. They saved the over 3,000 works by Vincent van Gogh, which were not selling to anybody at the time of his death. And so the story of the preservation of Kane, to me, equates with a handful of stories like that, where there seems to be something mystical out there that just keeps this work alive. This happens to be, I hate to say this for you 35 millimeter enthusiasts, this is a 4K print. It's the best looking print of Citizen Kane I've ever seen, with apologies to Quentin Tarantino. And all of you diehards out there that think that one day we will be led back to 35 millimeter, it's over. I'm just telling you what I know. There are about, 30,000 screens in the United States? Yeah. And over 90% of them have converted to digital.
But not the repertory houses.
Right.
Yeah. Can I just want to interject. I have to speak for the 35 millimeter. We couldn't do a series like the Wells series without 35 millimeter, so it's not over yet.
Because a lot of them haven't been transferred to 4K.
And a lot of them will never be.
Sitting up there in that room, there is no digital.
Exactly.
And the day there is, they'll be showing here. No dirt, no splices, no scratches. Will you see this thing? I'm not going to tell you how great it is. You will either discover that or not, or you know it already. But I'm very grateful to Bruce Goldstein and the finest repertory cinema in the United States for the opportunity to watch this film tonight and to briefly introduce it to you. I could go on with this longer than the film. I'm not going to. I suggest, guys, I'm going to sit in the back, that whenever you're ready, do us the honor of pushing that switch on Citizen Kane. Thanks, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you for listening to Film Forum's podcast. Visit us online at filmforum.org, where you can learn more about our films, memberships, subscribe to our free weekly e-newsletter, and to find out the ways you can support our nonprofit cinema. And if you have the time, please visit our iTunes page and leave a rating and review of our podcasts. Copyright to this program belongs to The Moving Image Incorporated.